So, welcome everyone. I'm going to be speaking tonight about the four Brahma Viharas to let you know what the other three are, because metta is just one of them. And I'll specifically be focusing on the fourth Brahma Vihara, which is equanimity, and how it relates to metta, to loving kindness, how it can support and help deepen our practice of metta, and vice versa. Because metta is one facet of the jewel of the Brahma Viharas, and equanimity is another facet. Together they work together and they shine because of each other. So as Donald mentioned this afternoon, the word Brahma Vihara, a Sanskrit term, it can be translated as a heavenly, sublime, or divine abode. Vihara meaning abode or dwelling. The Brahma Viharas are also translated as the four immeasurables, and they are expressed as boundless, infinite states that are illimitable. And when we develop them to a high degree in our meditation, these attitudes make our mind immeasurable, like the mind of a loving Brahma, one of the divine beings. So each of them is a seed that can be cultivated and can be developed without limit. So it's quite powerful if you think of the fact that we can each develop love in a boundless way, love that has no end. So the friendliness, metta, is just one of the four Brahma Viharas. So we have heard a lot about metta, this friendliness, benevolence, wishing well, wanting happiness and goodness for us and others. Both the intention and, as Thich Nhat Hanh would say, not just the intention, but also the capacity to offer happiness. Compassion, also known as karuna in Pali and Sanskrit, is the intention and the capacity to relieve and transform suffering and sorrow in ourselves and others. It's the way love is willing to be there, to be open, to feel what is painful, not numbing it, or turning away from suffering, but actually turning toward suffering with love. A profound willingness to be involved, to be engaged, to feel. And the third Brahma Vihara is translated as appreciative joy, others as sympathetic joy. It's called mudita. In Sanskrit and Pali. And so appreciative joy is where we celebrate the good things that happen to others. And it can also include ourselves, not just bringing joy to others, but also to ourselves, rather than envying or feeling resentful of other people's success. This kind of joy takes happiness, takes joy in others' joy. And the final one is equanimity. It's upeksha in Sanskrit and upekka in Pali. It's translated as equanimity, but also non-attachment, non-discrimination, impartiality, tolerance, or letting go. And my teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, also has added for me a helpful nuance, translating it as inclusiveness. And so upe means over or all around, and ksha means to look, upeksha in Sanskrit. So upe, over, ksha, to look. So to look all around, to see the whole picture. So like you're standing up on top of a high mountain and you can see all sides, not just, you know, one small perspective. So these are the four. Each of these four is an aspect of true love. It's an aspect of an awakened heart that's ready to meet the world and care for self and others. And Bhikkhu Anālayo, in the book that Donald showed you today on compassion and emptiness, offers a beautiful image of these four different elements of true love using the simile of the sun to help us understand these four qualities of love. So I'll read this to you from his book. It says, regarding the distinct quality of each divine abode, meaning each Brahma Vihara, in the context of the sun simile, metta would be like the sun at midday in a cloudless sky, illuminating everything equally and providing warmth in all directions. Just as the sun shines on what is high and low, clean and dirty, so metta shines on all without making distinctions. The sun keeps shining independently of how its rays are received. Nor does it shine less because people move back indoors. Oh, the sun keeps shining independently of how its rays are received. It does not shine more if people move out into the open to be warmed by its rays. Nor does it shine less because people move back indoors. Similarly, metta does not depend on reciprocation. Its rays of kindness shine on others out of an inner strength that pervades all bodily activities, words, and thoughts, without expecting a return. From the center of one's heart, metta shines its rays on anyone encountered, just as the sun shines in all directions from its position in the midst of the sky. Compassion, in turn, would be like the sun just before sunset. Darkness is close, almost palpably close, yet the sun keeps shining. In fact, it shines all the more brilliantly, beautifully coloring the sky at sunset. Similarly, when being face to face with suffering and affliction, the mental attitude of compassion shines even more brilliantly, undeterred by all the darkness found in the world. At sunset, the sun appears as if it were moving downwards. So too, compassion is willing to reach out to those in a less fortunate position. Continuing with the sun imagery, sympathetic joy would be comparable to the sunrise in the early morning. The birds are singing merrily, the air is fresh, and the surroundings are illuminated by the rising sun and appear as if pervaded by joyful delight. At times, the rays of the sun touch a dewdrop on a flower or tree and break into a myriad of colors. In the same way, the joy of others can become the source of a myriad of joyful rejoicings in oneself. At sunrise, the sun appears as if it were moving on an upward trajectory. This mirrors the disposition of sympathetic joy to direct positive feelings towards those who are in a better position than oneself. The fourth of the divine abodes, equanimity, is then like the full moon on a cloudless night. Just as the sun and moon are both up in the vast sky, in the same way the four Brahmaviharas share with each other the boundless nature of a mind that has become vast like the sky. The moon is not itself a source of sunlight, unlike the sun. So too, equanimity is not actively involved with others in the way the other three Brahmaviharas are. At the same time, however, the moon does reflect the light of the sun, just as equanimity reflects within itself the positive disposition of the other divine abodes. So I find these visualizations of metta as the sun at noon, shining on everyone, compassion, karuna, as the sun setting, meeting the darkness, joy, mudita, as the sun at the sunrise, beginning the day, and equanimity as the moon reflecting the light of the sun in the vast sky. These are helpful images, and what they show is that the first three Brahmaviharas all have this quality of warmth. It's the actual sun that's representing each of these three qualities, while equanimity has a cooler quality. It's only a reflection of the sun in the moon. So this coolness does not mean it's uncaring. It is full of love, equanimity. It is a face of love. But what's powerful about equanimity is it helps balance the other three so that we don't burn out in our caring, in our expression to others. It keeps a balance. Think of compassion fatigue, that we can outpour to an extent that we actually become exhausted. And equanimity helps keep our compassion in balance. So there's a lot more to share about the practices of compassion, karuna, and joy, mudita, but I want to focus here on equanimity, upeksha. So a little bit more about what this quality is. So it's this ability to stand firm and not take sides. So when Thich Nhat Hanh, my teacher, was asked to sign a petition against abortion, he's a Buddhist monk and he teaches protection of life and reverence for life, but he refused to sign this petition because he felt he didn't want to be dogmatic, insisting that one thing is right in all situations. He had experience working with people escaping from Vietnam after the war, where he knew of people who had been in all sorts of unfortunate situations like rape. And he knew that to force someone to have a child that they did not want due to rape, for example, could be very tragic for both the mother and the child. So his teaching was about openness, the need for openness, and not being ideological or dogmatic or imprisoned in our views. So that was an example to me when he refused to sign this petition of caring with equanimity, with the insight of what's really the full picture here, not just one view. And so Gil Fronsdal, a teacher in the Vipassana tradition, has some beautiful things to say about equanimity. And he says it's one of the most sublime emotions of Buddhist practice. It's the ground for wisdom and freedom and the protector of compassion and love. So it actually protects those parts of us so that we can deepen them and grow them. While some may think of equanimity as dry neutrality or cool aloofness, mature equanimity produces a radiance and warmth of being. The Buddha described a mind filled with equanimity as abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. So he says that there's two separate Pali words used by the Buddha for equanimity, and they're translated differently in English, and they each have a different quality, different aspect of equanimity. The most common Pali word translated as equanimity is upekkha, which I mentioned, meaning to look over, to look around. And it refers to the equanimity, this is Gil Fronsdal, that arises from the power of observation, the ability to see without being caught by what we see. When well developed, such power gives rise to a great sense of peace. Upekkha can also refer to the ease that comes from seeing a bigger picture. Colloquially, in India, the word was sometimes used to mean to see with patience. So we could understand this as seeing with understanding. For example, when we know not to take offensive words personally, we're less likely to react to what was said. This form of equanimity is sometimes compared to grandmotherly love. The grandmother clearly loves her grandchildren, but thanks to her experience with her own children, is less likely to be caught up in the drama of her grandchildren's lives. So again, that sense of coolness, that sense of spaciousness. So I remember when thinking of this kind of how do we face the world as it is, and not be kind of flattened by it, not be completely overwhelmed by it. And it made me think of this story that Thich Nhat Hanh tells of when he was a young monk and looking at the Buddha's smile. So this is what he writes. He says, "When I was a novice, I couldn't understand why, if the world is filled with suffering, the Buddha has such a beautiful smile. All these statues with the Buddha with a half smile." So Thich Nhat Hanh wrote, "Why isn't he disturbed by all the suffering? Later, I discovered that the Buddha has enough understanding, calm, and strength. That's why the suffering doesn't overwhelm him. He's able to smile to suffering because he knows how to take care of it and help transform it. We need to be aware of the suffering, but retain our clarity, calmness, and strength so we can help transform the situation. The ocean of tears cannot drown us if compassion is there. That's why the Buddha's smile is possible." So that smile of the Buddha is rooted in equanimity, in seeing the reality from all sides. And when I was practicing as a nun, I had a kind of similar question come up when I was doing a meditation. And the words of the meditation are, one part of it says, "Breathing in, I dwell in the present moment. breathing out, I know this is a wonderful moment. And I found myself stuck when I did this practice, genuinely wondering, with all the violence and hatred and inequality and tragedies that are happening in the world, how could we say this was a wonderful moment? And I genuinely was puzzled. And it was kind of this moment of truth, of like, well, I've been practicing this meditation for years, but how does this actually make sense to me? And I had to find it in myself in that moment. And then I just opened a little deeper to the realization that there are also many beings that are supporting others in this present moment. There are many hearts of compassion opening to relieve suffering, to care for others, to teach, to show a different way. There are, you know, people who are courageous and standing up for what they feel is right. And there are those that are quietly doing the things that no one else wants to do, that are cleaning places in nature that are forgotten, or caring for forgotten people, or, you know, doing what needs to be done. And so when I focused on that, I was able to touch, yes, this is, the present moment is also a wonderful moment. That suffering doesn't have to disappear in order for beauty to be there. That life is about all of these things. You know? So it was a moment of cultivating equanimity or inclusiveness, this ability to hold everything that was the reality, that there's great terror and pain, and there is great love and great wisdom, and they're all here in this moment. So I was drawn to speak about equanimity today because I feel there's a lot of heat in the world right now. And it's continuing to heat up. It's going to keep heating up. So there's a real need for the coolness of equanimity in these times. If we think of this attempted coup last week and the storming of the Capitol, how do we relate to these forces with clarity and fierce compassion, calling these people to justice without dehumanizing them? How do we include them in our hearts? So I have a friend that I teach retreats to teenagers with, Jack Blackfelt. He works as a technician in the metro in Washington, D.C., but he shared this story of encountering people who had been at this protest, at this, well, I don't know where they were, if they joined the mob at the Capitol or if they just went to the rally, but they had MAGA hats and had Trump regalia. So this is a story about encountering them the day of the riot. Next day. He says, yesterday, the very day after the Capitol was violated, I was doing my job as a technician for part of our transit system. A quartet of youngsters, two male-female couples with no masks and lots of star-spangled USA regalia, and one of them with a MAGA hat, approached me. I was asked, so you're a local guy. Anything you'd like to share about all this that's been going on? I had no idea if these people had been inside the Capitol building during the raid, or if they were merely at the rally on the Ellipse, or if they were just Trump-supporting tourists. With my mask hiding my expression, but still trying to convey some softness in my face, I looked the young man who asked me in the eyes and responded. You know, at first I was pretty angry, and I'm certain that I will feel angry again, and then settle some. But I will tell you this. I want to be a good example for my twin, almost 18-year-old boys, by not piling on into hysteria and judgment. I hope to demonstrate faith to them, not so much in others, but in their own good conduct. I'm very proud of who they are as a result, and I don't think I will ever hear of them doing anything like what happened yesterday. The young man nodded and seemed to uncomfortably assent with, "Yeah, I mean, you've got to try and keep an open mind, right? There's so many different people with different perspectives." With this, I nodded my head. I could sense that we had two very distinctly different worldviews, but this exchange was respectful. One of the young women warmed up immediately and told me that she had twins too. I didn't tell her how to raise her twins, but just said, "Right on. We want our kids to be safe and provided for, right? I'm glad I can say that because my dudes have been safe and provided for. I'm glad I can say that because my dudes have been safe and provided for, they don't live in fear of anybody, really." She just nodded and said something vaguely non-committal, like, "Absolutely." That was enough for them, and they moved on after wishing me a good day. I wished them the same. I don't think that I radically changed their point of view, but I showed them, at the very least, that someone with Black Lives Matter and Union Steward pins in full display on his reflective vest was ready to respond to their question honestly and without malice, since they approached me that way themselves. This isn't going to solve the problems of white supremacists trying to organize these kinds of people into their cadres in and of itself. But I do feel that if many of those who generally share my political outlook had less contempt prior to investigation about those they might oppose sociopolitically, then the violent extremists even further to the right of people like these folks would generally be less compelling and attractive for them to follow. So he ends by saying, "May we stand in our truths with equanimity and shared humanity." So it takes a measure of equanimity to have a conversation like that, to be able to hear what someone is saying and also what they're not saying, to be present to all that we know, but all that we don't know. So I was talking with my dad about these events. My dad's a Buddhist Dharma teacher, but also a Christian minister. We teach retreats together. And he was saying that when we see ourselves as victims, that's seeing ourselves as a separate self. But when we see ourselves as the beloved, that's no self. That's seeing our interbeing. So when we see ourselves as beloved, we're full of metta. We see everyone in us, and we see ourselves in everyone. So we have nothing to defend. During the war in Vietnam, Thay wrote a poem saying, "Man is not our enemy. A human is not our enemy." If we see ourselves as beloved, we don't have enemies. That's the power of equanimity and and inclusiveness. Just today, I received a wonderful reflection. Kazu Haga, a lovely person and teacher, runs the East Point Peace Academy and offers teachings and events on fierce vulnerability. And he shared this quote from activist Barbara Deming from her essay entitled Revolution and Equilibrium, about the two hands of nonviolence. So she wrote, "With one hand, we say, stop what you are doing. I refuse to honor the roles you are choosing to play. I refuse to obey you. I refuse to cooperate with your demands. I refuse to build the walls and the bombs. I want to disrupt the easy pattern of your life." But then the advocate of nonviolence raises the other hand. It is raised outstretched, maybe with love and sympathy, maybe not, but it's always outstretched. With this hand, we say, I won't let go of you or cast you out of the human race. I have faith that you can make a better choice than you are making now, and I'll be here when you're ready. Like it or not, we are part of one another. So this is the many faces of loving kindness, of metta. Equanimity is part of that face of love that says, I will stop you from doing harm. I will put you in jail if I need to do that, but I will never stop believing in your humanity, in the possibility of us finding a path of reconciliation. And this is a similar heart message from Dr. King in his essay, Loving Your Enemies. To our most bitter opponents, we say, we shall match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering. We shall meet your physical force with soul force. Do to us what you will, and we shall continue to love you. We cannot, in all good conscience, obey your unjust laws, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. Throw us in jail, and we shall still love you. Bomb our homes and threaten our children, and we shall still love you. Send your hooded perpetrators of violence into our community at the midnight hour and beat us and leave us half dead, and we shall still love you. But be ye assured that we will wear you down by our capacity to suffer. One day we shall win freedom, but not only for ourselves. We shall so appeal to your heart and conscience that we shall win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory. I don't know, but if Dr. King were with us today, he might add, attempt a coup, desecrate the halls of our government, terrorizing our elected representatives, infiltrate our police forces with white supremacists who open the doors of the Capitol to a violent mob and take selfies with them, and we will still love you. We will hold you accountable and work to keep you from continuing to cause harm, but we will still love you because you are us and we are you. I mean, this is something for those of us living in the United States, maybe North America at large. It is something we really have to come to terms with somehow. Half of our country voted for a man who they had seen for 4 years do the things that he did, like putting children in cages, separating parents and children at the border. You know, being very irresponsible with this pandemic. Still, half of this country of the United States voted for him. So we share this country, right? How do we hold all of this? So I once saw a cartoon of the word them, big open letters, and inside in very tiny letters, hundreds of times, was the word us. Us. Them is us. Us is them. So Sharon Salzberg tells a story of doing metta practice intensively for 6 weeks in Burma with her teacher. And she goes in for her interview and her teacher asks, if you were with a friend, if you were with an enemy, if you were with a neutral person, so four of you, and bandits came and said, you have to sacrifice one person. We're going to need to kill one of you. And you have to decide who it is that's going to be killed. And she meditated on this first day or so. And she came back to her teacher and she said, I've really looked to see in my heart my real truth, my real true answer to this question. And she said, I don't see the difference between any of us. I can't choose. An enemy is in the group. A neutral person is in the group. A friend is in the group. And she herself. I don't see any difference. I can't choose. So Thich Nhat Hanh, speaking about true love, says, if our love contains elements of attachment, discrimination, prejudice, grasping onto opinions, then it's not true love. So equanimity is not indifference or coldness. It means you love all of your children without discrimination, not that you don't love them. You love, but without discrimination. So we also don't discriminate between ourselves and others. So even if we're very involved in a conflict, the practice, and this is an advanced practice, I would say, but it is to stay impartial, capable of loving and understanding as best we can, all parties in the conflict. When we're able to put ourselves in the skin of the other person, the other group, and see them as ourselves, to see that there's no I and no other, then we can truly love them. If I see myself as the one who loves, and as the other as the one who is loved, if I somehow see myself as superior or different from the other, that's not true equanimity. That's not true love. So with equanimity, we're able to take a longer view that each person has their own journey, their own path to walk, that we don't always know what the logic of their trajectory is. We can't see what it is that they need to go through in their life. And equanimity also is the ability to see that This life is made up of what the Taoists call the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. That is life. All the beauty, the happiness, the wonder, the connection, the belonging, and all of the separation, the anxiety, the depression, the despair, that is the human life. And so this ability to step back and see this big picture, everyone has their own journey to go on. We don't know what each person's unfolding needs to be necessarily, and that we all, each of us, have our own measure of joy and sorrow that's unavoidable. So equanimity knows how not to make things worse when suffering is there. Suffering comes and there's inevitable pain, but there's an optional piece to that pain, which we can choose to add on to by resisting and pushing it away or judging it. Or we can just say, this piece is part of life. I'm not going to add more onto it by resisting it and blaming because it's here. So when I received the Bhikshuni vows, they were, this one part was kept secret. It was this very important piece of the ceremony that we weren't allowed to know about ahead of time. So the Bhikshuni means a fully ordained Buddhist nun. So you were a novice and then you take 348 precepts, vows to become a Bhikshuni. So on that day, they read to us four ways of dealing with certain situations. Four things we were vowing to do as part of being a nun, fully ordained. And it all was about basically maintaining equanimity in the face of aggression. And so one of them was, if someone insults me, I won't insult them in return. If someone beats me, I will not beat them in return. So there were four things like that. And I just remember feeling so moved when I heard these four practices, that basically no matter what, you know, harm or malice or even physical, you know, aggression someone would meet me with, that I wouldn't return that to them. And it doesn't mean that we, you know, that we let ourselves be a doormat for people, but it means that we are committing to nonviolence, to really uprooting ill will. It's a real commitment to metta. And we can see this in the life of the Buddha. He was insulted and he didn't take that personally. He didn't insult people in return. Many people misunderstood him. They were threatened by him. He maintained his equanimity. People even tried to assassinate him. His own cousin tried to assassinate him, and he got wounded in that attempt. Someone tried to push a boulder to crush him, and he got out of the way, but a piece of stone cut him. And he forgave his cousin, and he welcomed him back into the Sangha when he asked for forgiveness. So there was also a time when his whole community, the Buddha's whole community, was maligned, was slandered by people who resented him and felt threatened by him. And he didn't take it personally. He didn't react. He didn't get angry. He understood what was behind these unskillful actions, and he worked to get to the root and address the root cause of this conflict. So we can each do this in our own lives. We can meditate on what is it that really differentiates us from the people in our lives that we find difficult. I was teaching in South Africa, in Botswana, some years ago. A friend who's a doctor who treats HIV patients in Botswana, works for HIV prevention. She was telling us that she practices loving kindness every day. That's her practice every morning. She had a very difficult relationship with her boss at the time. She was really miserable in this position, and her boss was really, really difficult person. She practiced metta every morning, and she included her boss in her practice of metta. And she said, maybe a month or two into this, her boss was the one who came and presented to her an introduction to what would become her dream job, which she got. It was her boss that helped her get her dream job at another place. So she was really moved by the fact that even though she had a very difficult relationship with this boss, she kept including her in her practice of metta, and there was a real shift. Of course, we don't practice metta with that goal in mind to make people be different, but sometimes it happens just on its own. So there's a way also in which this practice of equanimity, of inclusiveness, it gives us a lot of courage. When that quote earlier of the Buddha saying that when you have equanimity, you have a mind of immeasurable peace. When you have peace, you have a lot of freedom, and you're not so afraid. So I watched a film a couple weeks ago about the life of Bishop Romero of El Salvador, who became a saint in the Catholic Church some few years ago. He was willing to give up his life for what was right and what was just in the midst of a great deal of violence and terror in his country in the 80s, 70s and 80s. That courage comes from this coolness of upeksha, of equanimity. There's a scene in the movie where the military was becoming more and more emboldened, and they had taken over a main church in San Salvador. And he needed to enter this church to get the, I don't know if it's manna, the what you use to give Holy Communion, the bread. And the soldiers are very unsympathetic to the bishop. And he came in insisting he needed to get this bread to give mass. And the head sergeant just took his gun, machine gun, and shot up the altar where all of this holy bread was kept. And he was quite shocked, Bishop Romero. And so they push him out of the church violently, laughing at him and saying, "This is our place. You get out of here." He goes to the car and his driver is about to drive him away. And then he closes the door. He looks at all the people, his, you know, churchgoers who are standing outside of the church, and he realizes he can't just leave. So he goes back in, and they point their gun at him, and they say, "Well, shoot." He says, "Well, then shoot me." And he just goes and gets this manna, this bread. And they don't know what to do because he's not afraid to die at that point. So he picks up the bread. And then you see him leave and go in the car. And then he comes back a few minutes later with all of his vestments that he needs to say Mass. And then all of the people who've been standing in the square, he heads into the church where the soldiers are still with all of their guns. They all have them pointed at him, rows of soldiers. People are behind him, and he just keeps walking. And all of the people walk into the church. And the army realizes they just back down in the face of that non-fear. They can't stop him. So he gets up on the whatever that place is called, and he says Mass. It's a really powerful scene in the film where that kind of conviction comes over him. Like, this is what's right. This is what I need to do. You need to do what you need to do. If you need to shoot me, but I need to do what I need to do. It doesn't depend on what you do or don't do. So there's great power in cultivating equanimity to fortify ourselves with non-fear, with compassion, with acceptance, with the ability to face reality but not be crushed by reality. So I'd like to offer a song to close. It's from a poem that Thich Nhat Hanh wrote called Recommendation, about his experience working to end the war in Vietnam, being seen as a traitor from all sides by the North Vietnamese army. He was seen as being pro-South Vietnamese by the South Vietnamese army. He was seen as a communist. But he wasn't part of either ideology. He just wanted the war to end. But for that, he was seen as an enemy. So that's sometimes what equanimity does, is it makes, if you don't take sides, then everyone sees you as their enemy. But even so, you keep going. So this is what this poem is about. It was put to music by monks, Catholic monks of the Weston Priory. So I'll offer you this song. Alone again, I'll go on with bent head, but knowing the immortality of love. And on the long rough road, both sun and moon will shine. Promise me this day While the sun is just overhead, even as they strike you down with a mountain of hate and violence, remember, brother, man is not our enemy. Just your mercy, just your love, invincible, limitless. Hatred will never let you face the beast in man. And one day when you face this beast alone, your courage intact, your eyes kind, out of your smile will bloom a flower, and those who love you will behold you across 10,000 worlds of dying. Of dying and birth, alone again, I'll go on with bent head, but knowing the immortality of love. And on the long road, both sun and moon will shine, lighting my way. Ooh. Thank you for your kind attention. So, I invite us now to once again check in and just see how we want to move with metta in the next bit of time before our chanting session begins. In, I think, an hour and a half. Is that right, Donald? In an hour and a half from now is chanting, which Donald will lead us in. So just take a moment to think, to see how you wish to practice after this session ends, and you will continue with your metta practice. Thank you. Shin Yu all. Fruitful practice. Is there any other thing that needs to be shared from anyone? Okay. All right. See you soon.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.